Okay, so this is a reading from the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of Fours, Sutta 125. The sutta is called Loving Kindness. Bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. What for? Here, bhikkhus, some person dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So one quarter means like one direction, like let's say to the north, you know, it's one quarter, okay? Likewise, the second quarter, okay? So let's say, you know, the east or the west or whatever, you know, four quarters. Okay? The second quarter, third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. So this vast, exalted, measureless. To me, this is suggestive of doing a space meditation, okay? Let me say it again. Vast, exalted, measureless, okay? So just like if you look at the sky, it's vast, it's measureless, okay? You're looking into outer space. It goes on, like, forever, okay? Okay, without enmity, without ill will. He relishes it, desires it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often dwells in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of Brahma's company. The lifespan of the devas of Brahma's company is an eon, or a kappa. Okay, it's an extremely, extremely long time. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the sphere of afflicted spirits. But the Blessed One's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he attains Nibbana in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is a future destination and rebirth. Again, some person dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere. Okay, so this applies like above, okay, and also below. Okay, so again, to me, this is speaking to mindfulness of space, and it goes above you and below you, too. Okay? Okay. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with compassion, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. He relishes it, desires it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is for a minute focused on it, often dwells in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of streaming radiance. The lifespan of the devas of streaming radiance is two eons. Okay, so this time two eons for compassion. Only one eon with loving kindness, okay? Two eons in this one, in this paragraph. The worldling remains there all his life. And when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the sphere of afflicted spirits. But the Blessed One's disciple remains there all his life. And when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he attains final Nibbana in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is a future destination and rebirth. 3. Again, some person dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with altruistic joy. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. Okay, so even though we're not hearing anything about the space element, space object of meditation, there is this like poetic language about it. Okay, and it's getting repeated every single time, each paragraph. Okay, and that emphasizes it. When things get repeated, it emphasizes it. Okay, he relishes it, desires it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often dwells in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of refulgent glory. The lifespan of the devas of refulgent glory is 4 eons. Okay, so we went from 1 to 2 and now 4. Okay, so now that's if we, that's for developing altruistic joy. Okay, so mudita. Okay, the worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the sphere of afflicted spirits. But the Blessed One's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he attains final nibbana in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is a future destination and rebirth. 4. When some person here dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter, thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. I just want to point out, too, when it says pervading the entire world, I think they literally mean, like, an area of space so big, it's like the entire world. Okay? That is possible. It's not just you're imagining the world. No, you feel an area of space as big as the world. Okay. Now, if he is firm in it, focused on it, often dwells in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of great fruit. The lifespan of the devas of great fruit is 500 eons. 500.
So
yes. This is a big jackpot here. Okay, so we went from 1 to 2, then 4, now 500. Big jackpot. Okay. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he goes, he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the sphere of afflicted spirits. But the Blessed One's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he attains final nibbana in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is future destination and rebirth. These bhikkhus are the 4 kinds of person found existing in the world. Okay? So we get way more details in these few suttas I'm reading than normal. You know, we actually get the names of the devas, etc., how long they live in their heavens. By the way, an eon or a kappa, okay, here's an analogy of how long an eon is. Okay, so, and there are several analogies, but they're all similar. Now, but the one most commonly explained is like this. Imagine a cube of solid metal, okay? So the cube is so big that every side of it is a yojana. A yojana is about 16 kilometers. Okay, so the cube of metal is 16 kilometers tall and 16 kilometers on all edges. Okay, 16 kilometers. Okay? Now, once every 1,000 years, and this is the kind of metal that doesn't just rust away in the rain, okay? Every 100 years, a dove flies up to the cube of metal with some silk in its beak, and it swoops down and brushes the metal once with the silk, okay? And that bird only comes once every 100 years. Once every 100 years, it brushes the metal cube once with the silk, okay? Sooner would that whole cube of metal completely wear away to nothing than would a kappa go by, okay? Or would an eon go by? So eons are so long that they are even longer than that time it takes for that bird to wear that metal down to nothing with the silk, okay? Which is like just completely boggles the mind, right? Okay, so now in this sutta, even if you can cultivate loving kindness and really establish it well, you get to go to this heaven for an eon, the Brahma's company. If you are like the Dalai Lama, let's say you're an awesome compassion master, you know, meditator. Okay, if you become like a master of that, you can go to companionship with the devas of streaming radiance for 2 eons. And if you master mudita, or sympathetic joy, okay, just like the 5-year-olds at the birthday party with the kazoo, right? Okay, you can go to you can have companionship with the devas of refulgent glory for 4 eons. And if you become an equanimity master, which is the hardest, you can go to the realm of, it's the devas of great fruit, and the lifespan is 500 eons. Okay? Now, whether you attain Nibbana or not depends on whether you were a well-instructed noble disciple, as opposed to an uninstructed worldling who will go next to the ghost realm, the hell realm, or the animal realm. They actually go down after that heavenly realm, which is really, really weird, you know? That's weird, like to go to heaven for so long and then down to a lower realm right after. That's really weird. Yeah. Okay, so that was...
this is not Sudawasa, right? And it seems like the sutta suggests that they are not coming back.
It's only the instructed noble disciple who doesn't come back and attains Nibbana. Yeah.
If we focus on metta, because it only takes 1 eon, then we can go to Nibbana.
That is one way to see it, you know. What I would suggest is whichever of these 4 Brahmaviharas is the easiest for you, just do that. Easiest one. Yeah. Yeah, like I find on any given day, if I ask myself, okay, which of these 4 is the easiest? One of them will be the easiest. And it's usually not my choice. You know what I mean? It's not like I want this one to be easy and then it's easy. No, like it's sort of like the Brahmavihara picks me. It's not like I pick it. It picks me for being the easiest one. Yeah. So I would say like take what you can get, whichever one's the easiest one, do that. Yeah.
Bhante, it says instructed noble disciple, right? Noble disciple. Is it noble disciple?
Aryasika? It's Arya Sawakasa.
Okay. It's out of reach.
It's one of the...
Yeah, it's... Sutta Wato is learned, well-studied, educated, initiated... And then Arya Wasaka is
okay.
Yeah.
Orange.
Disciple of the Noble Ones, a noble disciple. Okay, well anyway, you can analyze this one later if you want. It's Anguttara Nikaya 4.125. Okay. Are you ready for another one?
Yes.
Okay, so this is the next one, 4.126. Bhikkhus, there are these kind of four persons found in existing in the world. Here, bhikkhus, some person dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise a second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. He contemplates whatever phenomena there pertain to form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a boil, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of the pure abodes. This is a rebirth not shared with worldlings. Okay? This is a rebirth not shared with worldlings. So this is interesting. Same thing, loving kindness. Okay? Four quarters, above, below, same thing. But there's further contemplation of form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness. So those are the five khandhas. Okay? Those are the five khandhas. And they are contemplated as being impermanent, suffering, disease, a boil, a dart, etc., and non-self. So you'll recognize that as the three characteristics. Okay? The three characteristics. Suffering, impermanent, and non-self. Okay, so five khandhas, three characteristics. Okay, so this isn't just a Brahmavihara, it's contemplating as well. And it's for the sake of seeing everything as, it's a disease, it's a boil, a dart, it's misery, it's an affliction, it's alien, it is disintegrating, and it's empty. Okay? Now, likewise, this paragraph repeats, okay, again, some person dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, and likewise, altruistic joy, and likewise, equanimity. So it's the same paragraph for each of the four Brahmaviharas. Okay, likewise, the second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. Okay, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. He contemplates whatever phenomena there pertain to form, feeling, perception, volitional formation, volitional activities, and consciousness, as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a boil, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of the pure abodes. This is a rebirth not shared with worldlings, okay? So this is interesting. In all four cases, it went to the same realm, the pure abodes. No worldlings go there. So it's always thanks to this extra contemplating. The five khandhas, three characteristics. Okay, and it doesn't matter which of the Brahmaviharas you do this with. All right, you know what? I better save my voice. There's one more sutta I want to read, but I'll save it for this afternoon. So tomorrow, Saturday, is the last day. And I think it'd be nice to have like a sharing circle activity, a sharing circle where we all sit in a big circle and we each have an opportunity to share something with the group. Like, how are you feeling? How was your retreat? You know, did you have any insights? Was there something special, you know? that you feel like sharing. But if you don't want to say anything, you know, you're too shy, perhaps, okay, then you can just pass the mic. You don't have to say anything. Okay, so... Well, I was thinking like early afternoon. Early afternoon, yeah. Like how about at 2:30, yeah. Yeah. And now, I also want to mention quick, the reason I wanted us to meet here, I do have some allergies to dust, and I think my allergies are starting to act up in the Panya Hall there. Yeah, I was getting a lot of itchiness in my nose, like, and also sometimes when I would talk, I would be like gagging, like I'd be talking, you know, and like I need to drink some water, and I talk some, like I was actually gagging, you know. Yeah, so there's, I asked them to clean the fan, the blue fan by my seat and the air conditioner. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, anyway, okay, so maybe I'll just ask quick, you know what, there's a lot of questions this morning. There were people who came at 5:30 and I never even got to everybody. Do you have questions? You're free to ask questions.
Just how you're reading the Sudhavasa, how long is the lifespan?
It's not really spoken of. It's just you go to the pure abodes, and this rebirth is not shared with worldlings.
Is that a higher realm than
yes, yes. And although it doesn't say it here, everyone who goes there does attain Nibbana at the end of it.
So it's an anagami that gets to go there.
Basically, yeah.
What's the sutta number?
This is 4.126 in the Anguttara Nikaya.
Oh, I know.
Anguttara Nikaya.
Yes.
4.126.
126,
yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But this is like the energy of one aeon, 16 kilometer cube. What about one world cycle, beginning of the world form and to the end? How many eons that it takes?
Well, these things are spoken of in other suttas. I can't remember offhand, but it's usually just mentioned in the way of saying periods of expansion and periods of contraction, like universe expansion, universe contraction. Yeah, I don't recall anywhere in the early Buddhist texts where it states how many eons there are in one of these expansion and contraction things. That might be a commentarial thing. Again, I'd refer you to Bhante Punadamo, Ajahn Punadamo, his book on Buddhist cosmology. He did a good job of like gathering up all these details and kind of presenting them quite systematically. And because in the suttas, they're just kind of sprinkled everywhere. There's all these details laying around and, you know, sprinkled everywhere. So he actually kind of gathered these details into a, you know, nicely presented order. Yeah. And he states, you know, this was in there, you know, found here, this was found there, you know, what was in the commentaries, what's in the early Buddhist texts. Yeah, I'm unaware of anyone else who did this. And he took a long time to write this book. It took like over 10 years to write this book.
What is in my mind is from the Earth life is about 5 billion years. So the world, one world cycle is about 10 billion years, the scientists predict. So in that case, if you know one world cycle, how many eons, we can do the max. One eon, how many?
Okay, well, watch out though. Like, you know, back at the time of the Buddha, they had, you know, they invented the wheel and, you know, ox carts and, you know, bow and arrows and stuff like this. But they didn't even have a wheelbarrow yet, okay? They had not even invented the wheelbarrow at the time of the Buddha. So they, you can't really expect them to be like scientists who measure things really accurately. Like there was, it was only when the whole science thing came around was there this big desire, this big, you know, it's kind of a big change in the culture where they want to measure things very exactly, like to the centimeter, to the meter, to the liter, you know, everything they want to measure very accurately. But don't expect the suttas to have super accurate measurements, okay? Like, one of the things that John Puna points out is that there is a description of Mount Meru in the commentaries where the height of Mount Meru is given in yojanas. And it's like, you know, some in huge number of yojanas. It's like 1,000 yojanas tall or something, right? But I can't remember the number, but it is stated, okay? They gave a number. Now, but now in modern day, we know the exact distance from here to the moon. Like we're totally sure of that distance, you know, very accurately. And that estimate of how high Mount Meru is, it's something like 6 times higher than from here to the moon. Like Mount Meru is much higher than the moon is far away from us. So they were like way off. Yeah, so, you know, like there's an effort to present Mount Meru as big and amazing and venerable and, you know, kind of like holy, you know what I mean? And yeah, some exaggerating happens, you know. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, when you read this book of Ajahn Puna, you're going to see stuff like this. And, you know, it's the ancient world, okay? It's 2,500 years ago. I think they were giving, you know, the best measurement they could guess. Yeah. But, you know, if we can attain Nibbana, the teachings have done their job, okay? We don't need for it to be science. Like, that's a point that I would like to assure you with. Like, don't let this shake your faith in that. All that Buddhism ever claimed to do, or all that the Buddha ever claimed his teaching does, it helps you to attain Nibbana. So all of his teachings move in that direction. He doesn't make himself out to be also a scientist, okay? Or he doesn't make himself out to also be a psychologist or, you know, any other kind of expert. He just is an expert in Nibbana, okay? So I feel that's an important distinction here, is we run the risk of making claims we cannot defend when we take an attitude of like, well, we're going to be the experts of everything, though, not just Nibbana, okay? We're going to be an expert in how high Mount Meru is, let's say. Okay, well, it turns out it's not true, though. You know what I mean? It's like, well, maybe we shouldn't have made that claim. You know what I mean? If we are going to be wrong later on. That's what I'm saying. It would have been enough to just teach the way to Nibbana. That's all the Buddha teaches, okay? He's got this teaching about the handful of leaves. I'm sure you've heard this teaching many, many times. He teaches, you know, all the things he knows is like the number of leaves in the forest, but the number of things he teaches to his monks and, you know, the lay people, that's like a handful of leaves. So he just shows you what you need to see to get to Nibbana. But he leaves alone all this other knowledge over here, okay? Like being a psychologist or a scientist or whatever. Yeah, he doesn't have to prove to you he knows how high Mount Meru is or something like this. Okay?
Is this the Puna the same as the Mahathera Punaji?
No.
Canadian monk.
Yeah, it's a Canadian monk, Ajahn Puna Damo. So he has about 30 or 35 vasas now. He's about your age. He ordained with the Ajahn Chah lineage. Yeah, and it is not Punya Damo. Okay, it's not ends with the little tilde. It's just Puna, P-U-N-N-A, which means full of. So his name means full of Dhamma. It's not like wisdom Dhamma, Punya Dhammo.
Because this Punaji Mahathera,
or
he is
merit
also a scientist and also a philosopher, psychologist. And I just read something about him. He said, Buddhists shouldn't be bothered with anatta and anatta. Just focus on dukkha, and you can attain.
To that I would say, out of the three, anicca, dukkha, anatta, for any given person, one of those three will be more like kind of beneficial to investigate. Like it'll kind of, one will feel a sense of affinity with that teaching. One will feel like they can get a lot out of that teaching if they focus on it. And I think it'll be different for different people. For me, I think it's actually not self, it's anatta. Anatta is the one I tend to get the most out of. I feel it is not wise to just categorically state like, look, I'm going to decide for all of you which one of those three is your favorite. That's going to be dukkha. I made up your mind, it's dukkha.
But he mentioned it's in the sutta. He mentioned the sutta.
Well, I can cherry pick suttas all day long, brother. I can find some other sutta which says, actually, it's not self. If you just focus on not self, you can attain nibbana. Like there's always suttas which will boldly present something, right? And it very much might have been having the context of the audience at the time, okay? So maybe Bhante Piyadhamo here. Maybe if I had a real good sense of his personality, maybe I was like an excellent teacher, let's say. I can just read someone's character. I can just tell, you know? I don't have that skill, but let's just pretend I had that skill like the Buddha. So I could look him up and down. I'm like, you know what? There's this one teaching which is like the ultimate teaching. And maybe it's true for you, right? So I present that to you, okay? And maybe for you, if you actually focus on that, yeah, you can make tremendous progress. So the Buddha presents his teachings in many different ways. And whenever you take these suttas in isolation, sure, then you can make these claims. Well, look, it says right here, dukkha is like the ultimate one. But it might have been maybe dukkha is the ultimate one for you, the audience. You see? At the moment, the context is everything. Yeah. That's a theme that comes up over and over when I talk to the other monks. They study the Pali. They're like, look, the context is everything. You have to know the context. Who's being talked to? What can we know about that context? Because that has to do with how the Buddha chose to teach that lesson. Yeah, I'm very wary when monks make these bold statements like, this is the one teaching for everybody, okay? But maybe it's just more so for them, you know? Remember I said a few days ago, there's like hope, expect, mandate, okay? So instead of like mandating, you will focus on dukkha. That's the only way. I mandate it, okay? It's like, no. Let's turn that dial down, okay? I expect you'll get a lot of progress if you focus on dukkha. You know, maybe I expect a lot of progress if you focus on dukkha. Or maybe we turn the dial down to hope. Well, I hope if you focus on dukkha, you get benefits, you know. I'm optimistic it'll work. I'm optimistic it'll help, right? I just hope. Yeah, so watch that dial, you know. When it's slammed all the way up to mandate, it's like, okay, well, do the suttas bear that out? And not just one sutta. Like, have you read all the early Buddhist texts? Okay? Does it bear out when you look at all the suttas? Like, if you're going to make a mandate like that, you know, I insist you've done your homework on all, read all the suttas. Okay?
Speaking of audiences, in the first sutta just now, maybe it was for the arahants, because how do we know that our metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha are entirely pure without first purifying our hearts?
Well, Well, this is the kind of thing which can take a long time, a lot of practice. This can take years. This can take decades. And that's why monks and nuns ordain. Sometimes you need a whole lifetime to work on this. And it's a gradual thing. Don't be surprised when you find that there's still work necessary in some way. Okay, work necessary, like, you know, maybe you can meditate really well in the monastery, but then you go home and visit your family, and all of a sudden it's really hard to stay mindful, and it's hard to, you know, have your loving kindness or whatever. So, as the years pass, we discover these challenging times, like challenging occasions. Yeah. I've personally been getting a lot of benefit out of this. It is a Buddhist style practice called insight dialogue. It's not run by monastics, or at least there's just a very few monastics involved in it. It's mostly lay people, but they do all these different little exercises to see, can you stay mindful in all these different ways, all these different places and times, and, you know, can you bring up different topics of conversation and not go getting lost in a story or a narrative, or, you know, like they challenge you in all these different ways. Can you stay mindful? Can you even stay with, like, peace of heart? Can you stay with a Brahmavihara? They, like, challenge you in so many ways. And I really like that, because I keep discovering all these ways where I can't do it. It's, you know, I thought I was good at it, but then I find some way, actually, I'm not good at it. Yeah, so that's it. It takes time to find all these ways. And can you, like, overcome all, you know, all these challenges? It takes a long, long time.